Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, Intel releases Devil's Canyon. We review a $3,000 video card from NVIDIA, and the Xbox One controller is now available for your PC. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 271, recorded on June 12th, 2014. How about a $3,000 video card? This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by iFixit. You can fix it, and iFixit makes it easy with free step-by-step repair guides, high-quality replacement parts, and all the tools you'll need. For $10 off your purchase of $50 or more, go to iFixit.com/twit and enter the code TWITCH at checkout. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware. I am your host, Ryan Shrout. Patrick is out on assignment. Actually, he's spending some time with some family. I think a child is graduating, not from high school or anything, just from a lower grade than that. But filling in for Patrick today, we have industry stalwart. I don't know why I use that term, Josh. But Josh Waller's here to join me.
Hey, Josh. I'm Josh Walrath.
Are you an industry stalwart? Would you consider yourself that?
Am I an industry? Aren't I more like a citizen journalist?
Yeah. Yeah. And my microphone keeps tilting down. We'll fix it as we go. Patrick's not here, but we've got a show to do. We've got a lot of hardware stuff to talk about, in particular, some reviews that we posted over at PC Perspective this week. Right off the top, I just wanted to mention as a quick segue for anybody that is looking for something to do on Tuesday between, let's see, 4 and 6 p.m. Eastern and 1 and 3 p.m. Pacific. If you want, you can go to pcpro.com/live. We're going to have an interview with a gentleman by the name of Richard Huddy, who is, I've never called him this, but apparently he has been called the godfather of DirectX, which I'm assuming means, he had quite a bit to do with the beginnings and starting of DirectX. I think Microsoft actually purchased a company to create DirectX. Josh, does that ring a bell for you?
Wasn't it Alex St. John, his group?
He was in there.
They brought in. Yeah. I can't remember offhand. I mean, that was back in 1995.
This is why I asked you. This is why I didn't expect me to know. It would be a perfect story to ask him at the beginning of our interview that we're going to have on Tuesday. It'll be a live interview. And if you're interested in attending, not just because of the content we're going to ask. Now he works for AMD, by the way. We're going to ask about AMD versus NVIDIA topics with GameWorks and game development and game developer relations. But we're also going to give away a bunch of stuff. We're going to give away a Radeon R9 295 X2. And a 1,500-watt power supply?
That's a nice combination.
That's a great combination. Plus a 280X, a 280, a 270, a 270, a 260X, and 15 Never Settle Forever codes. So you have to be there watching it live to win those prizes. So I think set your alarm. Set your alarm. Go to pcpro.com and read that post and get all the information for that, because I think it'll be not just entertaining from the prizes, but entertaining for the cool information that I think we'll be able to get out of that story.
Yeah, I think that probably the more interesting thing that I would like to find out is what all he did at Intel and kind of his insights in what Intel has done in terms of graphics and developer support and software support to these guys, as well as, you know, drivers. Fun things like that. So
we'll see how much of his non-disclosure when leaving the company forces him to not answer anything.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the fact that he works at a competitor now. I don't know. These types of interviews are always interesting, but they told us that no topics are off limits. So we're interested in looking forward to that. But there was some interesting hardware that came out this week as well. The Core i7-4790K. This is the Devil's Canyon processor that we have talked about on this show, you know, since it was, you know, first we heard rumors about it, and then we in March, Intel kind of officially released and said, yes, we're going to have a Devil's Canyon part. Here's what makes it different. The differences between this processor and a standard Haswell part that you can buy today are you have a different thermal interface material, a polymer thermal interface material now, and they've added capacitors to the back of the processor that are supposed to smooth out power delivery to the die. All of this is in service of improving temperatures and improving overclockability, in theory. In practice, it did one of those two. It improved temperatures, but it did not really improve overclockability in my testing. But what it does do that's, I think, more interesting than its overclocking or temperature improvements is that it just boosts clocks up. So if you compare the 4790K to the 4770K, you're a 500 megahertz frequency difference. So the base clock of this new part is 4 gigahertz instead of 3.5 gigahertz. And the top turbo frequency is 4.4 gigahertz instead of 3.9. And all this selling for approximately the same price, $339 is what it's going up for pre-order shipping here within the next week or so.
25th, according I think, to isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Newegg and Amazon all kind of around that date, give or take a few. So, you know, benchmarks are what you would expect. It's 500 megahertz faster. The good thing about this is that it's not just, you know, when we talk about, you know, the performance of, say, an Ivy Bridge E part, even though it's a 6-core CPU, in single-threaded or just like 2-threaded applications, the Haswell part is actually faster, right? The 4770K. With the 4790K, this new Devil's Canyon CPU, it's an interesting release because you get extra performance everywhere, right? You're running 500 megahertz faster if you're just utilizing one core and one thread, and you're 500 megahertz faster if you're utilizing the entire processor. So it's a hell of a jump, and it in several of our benchmarks, it competes with the 6-core Ivy Bridge E processor now. What stood out to you in regards to this particular CPU release, Josh? I mean, was it the performance? Was it the temperature? Was it the price?
It was the price. I mean, they're offering a whole lot more performance, potentially better overclocking, and certainly better thermals. Not so much as it's still a, 88 watt
TDP?
Yeah. So, I mean, same TDP, but yeah, you're gaining all that clock speed. I know that the thermal interface has been something that a lot of overclockers have complained about. And certainly it's nice that Intel was able to kind of take those complaints and do something about it. But like with your overclocking, it doesn't improve it that much. Yes, at base clocks, your temperatures are going to be better because it's a more efficient heat transfer. But in terms of getting those transistors to switch effectively at above 4.7 gigahertz and above, that's more of a problem with the 22-nanometer Tri-Gate process. I mean, it just, until you can cool that puppy down much lower than the, you know, 35, 40, 50, 55 watt, 55 degree area, and I'm talking, you know, zero and sub-zero, and, you know, obviously LN2 is going to give you a lot more speed. But, yeah, just on air, and even pretty hefty air coolers, I don't know if we're going to see much of a difference, but who cares? It's faster at stock, and it costs the same.
Yeah, I for my overclocking, I was using a Corsair H80, which is a 120-millimeter self-contained water cooler. Right. But we have used that for overclocking on all of our, you know, I think Ivy Bridge and Haswell parts. And wasn't able to get anything magical out of it. And talking with the motherboard vendors who get their hands on a lot more processors than I do, right? I had one sample to test. They're probably going through dozens, if not more. And they're saying the average increase is probably 100 to 200 megahertz for a Devil's Canyon part versus a, you know, a standard Haswell
4770. CPU. Yeah.
So not much. The overclocking, it could be interesting. You know, there was some ranting and raving on Twitter the other day from an Intel representative talking about, well, what you really need to do is you need to get that processor down to like below 55C under load, and then you'll be able to overclock it. And I just don't think that's a realistic venture for most people.
Well, what temps were you seeing with the H80?
Under load at, well, let's see. I can go to that page and I can tell you. Under load, stock settings, I think I was at like 50 Yeah, 5051C. But when overclocked, I'm getting 84C, right? Anywhere from like 74 to 84C. Yeah, but for a Haswell part, that's not too bad, honestly. If you're like hitting peak thermal overclocking limit, like the 4770K, I was overclocking, hit 91C in the testing. So that's definitely toasty, and it's kind of on the verge of whether or not you would want to keep doing that for stability or lifespan issues. So the 4970K was better, but it didn't get us, like, for the gearheads out there, I was able to push my 4770K to 4.8 gigahertz at 1.25 volts. On the other hand, the new Devil's Canyon, I could only get 4.7 gigahertz, and it took 1.36 volts. That's a lot of voltage to send into a Haswell CPU to come up with 100 megahertz less than my 4770K. Now, it's a really, really, really good 4770K in terms of luck of the draw. But like we talked about on our show the other day, I have now read three reviews of Devil's Canyon, and all of us hit 4.7 on all of our samples from Intel, right? So either Intel did the worst possible job bidding parts and accidentally sent all the 4.7s to all the media, or this is kind of what to expect. So I still love the processor, though. If you are building a high-end machine today, like if you're building a gaming rig, you're building a new computer, you got a Z97 motherboard, and you were kind of debating the 4770K, you get the 4790K. Like, you just do that because it's 500 megahertz faster.
500
megahertz faster.
Of these.
Yeah. It's so many fingers. It's like 500 fingers of counting. Anyway. So that's Devil's Canyon. It's an impressive part, and I think it will be available by the end of June. So if you go to Amazon, or you go to Newegg, or you go to Micro Center, you can find pre-order links for all of that. Another interesting product was released recently, and I finally published a review of it, and that is this puppy here that I happen to have sitting in front of me. This is a GeForce GTX Titan Z, he says, holding it up in front of his face so nobody can see him. This is a $3,000 dual GPU graphics card. So underneath this shroud is a heat sink, and underneath those heat sinks are two GK110 GPUs, the same GPU essentially that is in the GTX 780 Ti and the GTX Titan Black. And this card was announced at the end of March, and then it was supposed to be released at the end of April, and actually ended up being released at the end of May. So there was a little bit of a delay in there. And the interesting political side to this release is that between the time that NVIDIA announced and then actually started selling the Titan Z, AMD announced and released the R9 295 X2, which is their own dual GPU graphics card. I have sitting on the table over here, but it's far enough away, I don't want to reach and break something. The Titan Z is $3,000. $3,000. And the R9 295 X2 from AMD is $1,500. So it's half the price. And in our testing,
weighs twice as much.
It only weighs 1 pound more.
Oh, rats. That's too bad.
For example, if you want to use that metric, the Titan Z is $1,000 a pound. And the Radeon R9 295 X2 is like, I don't know.
$350 a pound?
Yeah, there you go. $350 a pound. So in terms of value for weight, the AMD card is the better value. In terms of value for your dollar and gaming performance, it's still the better card for that. Because in almost all of our tests, the R9 295 X2 is faster than the Titan Z, and sometimes not by a small margin, sometimes 25 to 30%, especially when you get into 4K gaming. And that's kind of crazy to think that NVIDIA would attempt to sell a card for twice as much than a card that it's selling against. Now, NVIDIA likes to go out and talk to you about the fact that this card is really meant for CUDA developers, that it's really meant for the professional markets, that gaming is kind of like an also type thing. But that was not their messaging when the card was released or when it was announced back in March at the GPU Technology Conference. It was announced as the Motorola's most powerful graphics card, most powerful gaming card, perfect for high-end enthusiast gamers. And some of the, a lot of their messaging on the GeForce.com site today still claims that it is the fastest gaming graphics card. And that's, it's just clearly not the case. And I think that month delay was an attempt for them to try to, you know, after seeing what AMD did with the 295X2, what can we do to make this better? Can we increase the clocks? Can we, are we willing to go over power consumption? Because the Titan Z has a TDP of 375 watts. The 295X2 that you see in that photo has a TDP of 500 watts. So 125 watts more than the Titan Z. That is a significant, significant difference. The Titan Z is quieter and it uses less power. It's a three-slot card instead of a two-slot card, but the AMD card has a water cooler. Like, there's all kinds of weird trade-offs. But at the end of the day, gaming performance at 25 by 14 or 38 by 21, so 4K resolution, is that the AMD card is faster. And that's, you know, and the Titan Z, as you can tell, based on this labeling right here, has the GeForce brand attached to it. And GeForce brand is consumer-level gaming graphics cards. And it can be used for CUDA computing performance. Like if you're a CUDA developer, you don't want to spend $20,000 on, you know, Tesla units. You can spend $3,000 on this and have a super, super high-performance product. But from a gaming perspective, the it's not a great solution for
it. Not a great buy. Did you ever do test Luxmark on these?
I did not.
Oh, that's too bad.
I can. I've got them sitting here.
You probably should, especially if NVIDIA is really pushing that for you know, OpenCL and compute type.
They actually never use the term OpenCL.
Well, to no, be clear, not. Yeah,
they use CUDA, right? Because there is no better card for CUDA. Because no AMD card does it. So even if there was a higher, you know, I think the 295X2 will be faster for OpenCL as well, right? Just looking at theoretical compute performance, the AMD card's peak is 11.5 teraflops, and this card, the Titan Z, is 8.1. That's a huge difference again. So I think in OpenCL benchmarks, you would see the AMD card is actually faster. So NVIDIA's in a tight spot. I feel like they... you know, and other options would have been to drop the price of this, to take away double precision floating point performance, make it a gaming only product and cut the price in half. They could have canceled the part. But, you know, if they sell, what do we think they'll sell? 1,000 of these, maybe?
Maybe.
You know?
And how many of the old, do you remember the old GeForce 7800 GTX 512s? There was only a couple hundred of those ever made.
Yeah.
Barely remember. It was like, you know, 512 megs at the time when everything else was 256. I wonder if this is just going to be kind of that same thing. They're not going to... Next generation eventually will come around and it's going to overshadow this. And who cares? They're going to sell through their stock.
Right. As long as they sell all of them that they made, then it's not a lose for NVIDIA. Like they lose a little bit of, you know, maybe face with the public for...
The halo effect.
Yeah, like people, there are going to be some people that think that NVIDIA is trying to screw us over, right? They think we're idiots and they think that we're just going to pay $3,000 because it's got the GeForce brand on it. And there are people that will do that. But also, even though it's not in the review, I just added it actually up on PCPer.com today. I did do a Titan Z overclocking testing. It was a real quick thing. And the clock speeds of this part are significantly lower than the Titan Black or the 780 Ti. But what's interesting is to look at how those clock speeds improve if you just turn up the power target in EVGA Precision X, for example. And it can do pretty interesting things. Like if you, the average clock speed through 25 minutes of Metro Last Light at stock settings was 894 megahertz. Whereas if you turned power target up to 112%, which is not the maximum, 120 is the maximum, the average clock actually went up to 993 megahertz. So a full 100 megahertz faster on your GPU clock speeds by turning that up. And we did overclock it. We got up to 1074, which is about a 20% improvement in clock speeds and performance, right? So
how loud did it get at those speeds?
Got pretty loud. It got pretty loud. The fan was the fan at stock under load was like 2,000 RPM, and when overclocked after 25 minutes, it was like 2,700 RPM. So it was loud. It was loud.
Buzzing.
Right.
Nice.
So NVIDIA, it sounds like, it feels like to me like NVIDIA could have done more with this part had they, you know, really wanted to, but they seem content to just kind of let this part go out as it is, sell it to who they're going to sell it to, and not sell it to who they know weren't going to buy a $3,000 product anyway, and, you know, kind of move on.
Is this kind of like, you know, Intel and their highest end, Ivy Bridge E part, which is $1,000? How many of those do they really honestly sell?
I don't know. I'd like to know that too. You know, and I think most of those probably sell to the system resellers, right? People who are, you know, they're somebody who buys a $6,000 computer. It's got $1,000 CPU in it. Sure, whatever. Who cares? But I don't think there are many enthusiasts that would buy that because we know how close in proximity, like the 4930K is to the 3960X in terms of performance, and you can overclock at the same and all that other things. So I think it's similar to that. I would guess Intel sells a lot more of those flagship Extreme Edition processors than
probably one or two more. Yeah.
Titan Z. So Alan, not on the show, but he did write a review this week, the Plexter M6M. This is an mSATA SSD powered by the same Marvell controller that's in the new Crucial MX100. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this. It's a tiny SSD that will fit in mSATA ports, and it actually performs pretty darn well. I think surprisingly well from what he was basing on, because it only has four NAND chips on it, right? It has half the addressable number of actual chips it can go to, but it still outperforms a lot of higher end parts. If you look at something like the IOPS graph, for example, which is kind of, you know, your amount of operations per second that the device can handle, it's up there with like the 2.5-inch OCZ Vertex 460. It's up there ahead of the Samsung 840 Pro. It's ahead of the ADATA SP920, which is actually based on the same controller, I think, as the Plexter drive.
Yep.
So some really good stuff there. If you are looking to build a Nook or upgrade a laptop or something like that, I don't know. Or, you know, I guess, Josh, a lot of these motherboards have mSATA slots on them now. This would be a good use case for that.
Yeah, I've got, I think, one motherboard in total that supports mSATA here in my house. And I've got a few boxes behind me. I was just going to ask, have you ever actually built a system for yourself or for somebody else that actually uses one of these mSATA drives?
I did. I built a Nook for my dad for Christmas.
That's right, for his flight sims.
For his flight sims, right? And it has a an mSATA port in there. And then we have a, kind of in the office here, we have a floating motherboard. Not really floating, but it goes from system to system to do a couple of different operations. And it was one of the Z87 boards from Asus that has an mSATA slot on it. And we just leave that mSATA on there because that way we don't have to take an SSD or a hard drive around with it as it kind of migrates from job to job inside the office. So it can be useful for that. But, you know, if you're building a computer, even a mini ATX or micro ATX or a full-size ATX case, you're going to have room for an SSD. So the need for the small form factor in a desktop, I think, is fairly minimal. But yeah. Laptops get upgraded. Like, you know, Lenovo's and stuff, they use mSATA, right? Yeah, like that. They look like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's tiny.
Yeah. It is. Let's take a quick break here to thank the sponsor of today's podcast. That would be iFixit.com. It is the free online repair manual for everything. They have more than 10,000 repair guides. So maybe, Josh, they can fix all the stuff that your kids break, or they can help you fix all the stuff that your kids break. They have everything from electronics, like your smartphone, tablet, and game console, to even home appliances, clothing, and your bike. So,
how about, can it take dents out of my Explorer caused by baseballs?
Yeah, sure. Why not? I'll show you some toolkits that can absolutely help you stab holes into your Explorer. I don't know if it'll if it'll help remove the dents. It'll take it away, you know. They also have foolproof instructions to fix all of your stuff. If you've shattered your iPhone screen, you need to repair a red ring of death on your Xbox, or swap the battery on your Galaxy S3, iFixit has got you covered with parts, tools, and repair guides. Today, we are introducing two iFixit tools for you guys, the Pro Tech screwdriver set and the Magnetic Project Mat. This is the iFixit Pro Tech screwdriver set, and we use this all the time here at the offices at PC Perspective. In fact, before the show, I had to go take this back from Alan's desk where he had left it and not put it away properly. But he was using this throughout the day. He was taking apart, what was he taking apart today? He's taking apart a hybrid hard drive.
Probably your
so we could take pictures of the PCB. Hopefully he wasn't taking apart anything he wasn't supposed to. But inside it, you have 15 screwdrivers specifically chosen by the iFixit teardown team. The drivers can handle more than 90% of electronics repairs. They're designed for heavy use and delicate precision. They have black oxide tips for grip. You can see, I mean, they're not, they're small because they need to be small to work with small electronics, but they're tough. And they've got this spinning top there. I forget what they call that. But I like it. It allows you to rotate it while pushing pressure down with your palm. Oh, the swivel top design for added precision right there in the notes. A custom tool roll makes this a handy portable toolkit for amateurs and professional fixers alike, of which I am the former, the amateur. So lifetime warranty on it as well, $59.95 for this. You get all 15 screwdrivers that way. And another one is, I really like this, the Magnetic Project Mat. This, I actually had bought one of these well before iFixit became a sponsor of the show. It's an iFixit invention. It organizes all of your parts while you work on a repair. So it's just a mat that is slightly magnetic. And so it will hold all the screws and washers and nuts that come out of the device while you're taking it apart. And it's also dry erase, so you can take notes on it, right? So you put a handful of screws down, you put a circle around them, and you write the notes for, you know, upper left-hand corner of device or whatever it is.
Didn't you use that for your Xbox and PS4?
When we did our teardowns of devices, it was super handy, right? Because all of a sudden, if you don't do that, which I did not do when we tore apart the Wii U, I have this thing full of screws and I have no idea what any of them go to. And that's how you end up with 7 extra screws putting together a device again, which is a bad thing to do. So it's a super handy thing. It's only $19.95. It comes with a dry erase marker, and it's a really, really useful thing. If you do anything involving projects, taking apart phones, even taking apart laptops, we've used it for that. It's really, really handy. Actually, he was circling, it's on sale for $14.95. So definitely a chance for you to go pick it up. In fact, with iFixit, you can fix it yourself. Visit iFixit.com/twit for more than 10,000 free step-by-step guides. iFixit also sells every part and tool you will need. Enter the code TWITCH. That's TWICH at checkout. You'll save $10 off any purchase of $50 or more at iFixit.com/twit. So you can pick up these two items and get $10 off of your purchase at iFixit.com/twit. We thank iFixit for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware and for continuing to produce cool things. What is something else they released, actually unrelated to the ad spot, was they had like these microwavable pouches that had like a gel in them. And when you wanted to, like, say, take the glass off of a phone that had glue around the edges, you put this little pouch in the microwave, you heat it up, and then you put the pouch where the glue is, and it slowly warms up the glue. So you don't have to use like a heat gun and potentially overheat everything else around it. And then, you wait a little bit and you can just peel it off. Cool little things like that. Speaking of cool little things, Josh, do you have an Xbox One controller yet?
Nope, don't have an Xbox One.
Do you have an Xbox controller? 360?
I do have an Xbox 360 controller, yes. But luckily, the children did lose one of those already.
The good news is when you go to replace it, you can replace it with an Xbox One controller, which now has PC drivers available you can find them on PCPro.com, but they're available at Major Nelson's blog. So what's just interesting about these drivers is they basically tell the PC that this is an Xbox 360 controller, which for all intents and purposes, it really is. The only downside is, for now at least, you have to have it permanently connected to the system. You have to have a USB cable. You can't use any kind of wireless connectivity, which I think was what we all kind of want. But I don't think those controllers actually use Bluetooth, even with the console. You don't know that, do you, Josh?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Sony's still using Bluetooth and Microsoft's using like a Wi-Fi direct type thing.
Proprietary.
Yeah. Although it's other interesting Xbox One news, Josh, is that since the announcement that the Xbox One no longer required to ship with a Kinect in the box. I remember when we talked about this a while back when it was, you know, just rumors about, you know, after the E3 announcements before they actually gone on sale, that there were a certain percentage of shaders on the Xbox One's APU that were going to be dedicated to processing input coming from the Kinect. That's because it did things like when I say Xbox go home, when I'm in the middle of playing a game, it recognizes that and takes the appropriate action. If I'm sitting there playing a game or my wife's sitting there playing a game and I sit down on the couch, it recognizes me. It has a little pop-up that says, "Hey, Ryan, do you want to join this game?" And it does kind of creepy, odd things like that, but fairly cool from a technological standpoint, right? Now that they don't have to have a Kinect in the box, it looks like developers may get access back to some of that shader power. Do you think this will have any effect on Xbox versus PlayStation debates going forward, Josh?
Not a whole lot, because Xbox still has, I mean, it's got fewer shaders already. It's got far less memory bandwidth, which when you're dealing with any kind of graphics workload, memory is absolutely key. Even though they've got, the 32 megs of EDRAM built into the chip, it's still not a ton. But, you know, having a little extra performance, if the people want to, I mean, what's kind of interesting is that they are allowing these developers then to disable Kinect, I guess, when their game is playing.
Mm.
And that'll allow them more potential performance in this case.
I think the number goes from Scott wrote this up on our site, that the deficit in theoretical compute performance from the Xbox One to the PS4 will go from 36% to 29%. So Xbox One is still going to be slower in peak theoretical compute, but less slower, right?
Yes, but you know what I think is probably the most interesting, and this is going to be really interesting for AMD going in the future, but Microsoft has put the software in that can actually do real workloads instead of just graphics for these graphics units from AMD. And it kind of gives credence to AMD when they say, hey, my Kaveri processor, it's a 12-core or a 12-core unit, which eight of the cores are the graphics, and the four cores, of course, the pile driver. No, steamroller. So yeah, it's kind of interesting to see, more of the GPU type stuff is actually being put to use in a game console.
Yeah,
I don't know.
And now they took away that use, right?
Right.
Exactly. So Microsoft, by taking it out of the box, maybe that's not such a useful way to take advantage of that processing power. I don't know. It's interesting. I don't think it will change anything, but it was an interesting E3 from a games perspective as well. We've got a couple announcements. Before we get to E3, I do want to mention that PCI Express 4.0 is a thing, and it will be coming out soon, and it's 2x the bandwidth of 3.0, which was 2x the bandwidth of 2.0, which was 2x the bandwidth of 1.0. So, Josh, how fast does that make PCI Express 4.0?
It makes it really fast. It's something fast, 100 gigs by 16?
Gigabytes per second, something like that. 16 lane PCI 4 is 64 gigs total.
Oh, okay.
64 gigabytes per second per 16 lanes of PCI Express 4.0.
And, so that's more bandwidth than a GTX 7900 back in the day.
Yeah.
That's a 52 gig per second part.
Now, what's it going to do with all that is obviously the question, right? So if you took a current day processor and gave it 64 gigs of PCI Express bandwidth, what would it do with it? I don't think it would do very much different today. Do you think does this help, you know, a company like Intel get into the HSA style of compute a little bit more, right? If it can have like a GPU on an external card that can communicate at that kind of rate with the processor?
Possibly. It depends on, you know, obviously the architecture, if they can encompass such a thing as NVIDIA has already done with theirs and AMD with HSA. I mean, that is just a ton of bandwidth. And I think what is really kind of interesting is, you know, HP announced the machine, right? And using tons of memory, using the Memristor technology.
Mm-hmm.
What is this going to do with, like, two generations from now, SSDs that have, you know, potentially could use this technology? And you've got an I.O. system that's pushing 64 gigs. Well, it's going to be less than that, obviously, with the by four. But still, that's a ton.
I mean, it's kind of nuts, right? So, yeah, I the compute power on the other end of that to really do anything with 64 gigs of data. Think of how specific a GPU is to take advantage of 64 gigabytes per second of memory, and how very singular that job has to be for it to efficiently take advantage of that much bandwidth. I'll be curious to see. And I think also something that was brought up yesterday was like how much power these were going to require to run at that speed or anything like that. I don't remember. They're talking about needing heat sinks for traces. I'm sure we were joking. But
we might not be joking, but we'll see.
You need fans on your traces to run at 64 gigabytes per second on PCI Express.
Yeah, Gigabyte's going to come out and say, we used 8 ounces of copper in our motherboard because otherwise it will melt.
We actually had to use a pound. I'm sorry. That means your motherboard is significantly more expensive. That's unfortunate for you.
But you know what? You can really recycle it now.
That's right. And I think you'll get a lot more theft, a lot more motherboard theft going on as well. E3 2014, just a couple of quick notes here. Battlefield Hardline closed beta is up. That is a game based on Frostbite 3 engine that is using essentially the Battlefield gameplay style. Cops and Robbers, Josh, is that right? Is this something you would be interested in playing?
I don't know yet. Maybe. You're in the beta, aren't you?
It's installed on this system, but I have yet to start it yet. I've been busy messing with that Titan and everything.
Yeah, I saw a cartoon where a guy from EA, one of the executives, is looking down. He's got Grand Theft Auto, Battlefield, and Payday on it. And he's looking down, and then he gets a big grin as he crams them all together and comes Battlefield Hardline.
You know, I'll try it. I'm sure we'll try it, and I'm sure the Fragging Frogs gaming group will give it a shot if enough of them got into the closed beta. Also, there. Speaking of Grand Theft Auto, Grand Theft Auto 5 will be coming to the PC this fall, coming to the Xbox One and the PS4 as well. But wrapped into that is the PlayStation release, so that will be there. And then also, anecdotally, I saw news that. Apparently, Microsoft's releasing Halo 1, 2, 3, and 4 for the Xbox One this fall as well. And somebody saw during a demo where they had accidentally unplugged the Xbox controller, and the kind of in-game tutorial said move mouse to look. And as started rumors then that Halo 1, 2, 3, and 4, that pack may be coming to the PC eventually as well. So
boy,
I know,
that
Josh,
would be nice.
Aching to
I've
play
only
Halo.
I've played Halo 1. On the PC.
Really?
I skipped Halo 2 because the whole Vista thing made me mad.
Yeah, I understand.
And now they just don't sell it anymore and support it. And so it would be kind of nice to have.
Wouldn't
all
it be cool if it comes out, but you have to actually install Vista, like emulate? Maybe they install like a virtual machine running Vista.
Because you know DirectX 12 is coming to Vista, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
of course. All right. So that's kind of what E3 was. Now, we didn't expect a whole lot of hardware news to come out of that. Most of that was Computex, and there was a ton of it there. We're going to go ahead and answer a handful of questions that you got, that you guys have sent in. If you want to send us an email, we highly encourage you to do so. We need your questions. That email address is twitch@twit.tv, T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv. Now, here we go. Let's dive on in. We got an email from Will, who says, I just completed my first build, and I must say it went pretty well. I went with a Core i5-4670K, a Gigabyte Z97 UD3H motherboard, Corsair H80i cooler, and 16 gigs of G-Skill Ripjaws X-rated, X-rated memory at 1,866 megahertz. My question is, my computer is set to use the memory at 1,600 megahertz. Is there a way to change this so I can essentially use what I paid for?
I think, don't you, if you use the Intel XMP settings, that the controller will kind of max that out? I know on this older G1 Sniper running on the 3770K, I put in the 1,866 memory, turned on the XMP support, and it automatically set the timings and everything to the 1,866 speed. That's what happens on your end. I mean, I don't have as much.
So, Will, you can do this manually. Like, you can go in and, like, change the memory frequency, and then on your memory module, you should see, like, a list of numbers that will be, like, all the different timings. But that's kind of a pain in the butt, and that's the old way of doing things. What you should do now is there should be a setting to enable XMP profile, and that stands for extended memory profile. It's something that was created by Intel, and it's basically a easy way to overclock your memory to what it has been rated at by the memory vendor itself. So if you go enable XMP memory in your BIOS or UEFI, if you want to call it that still, it should boot and run at 1,866. So, and there may be an instance, I've seen some memory modules that have more than one XMP profile, right? You've got XMP number one, XMP number two. You know, try one, see what it boots up as. Try the second one, see what it boots up as, and you should go. The benefit of XMP is that you don't have to, like, worry about setting the voltage. You don't have to worry about setting what the cast latency is or any of those other timings that can be very confusing, even for me, looking back now. And
yeah, there are four major timings and, like, 32 sub-timings to that you got to get right to get everything stable. And enabling XMP just automatically does that.
You know, a certain person that we both know, Josh, side note, complained to me recently about XMP because he claimed that he created the idea of XMP with SLI memory. Right? Remember SLI memory? That was a thing.
I do remember. It does.
Chipsets. And he says Intel stole it, made it XMP. And it's like, yeah, well, should have got a patent on it, I guess.
Yeah, well, then AMD made AMP.
Yeah.
AMD memory profiles. Yep.
Yeah, but this was much later. Like, AMP didn't happen until pretty recently.
Yeah, it's only been about 2 years.
All right. This is an email from Andrew. Actually, I put this question in here because Alan had been complaining about this earlier. I'll get your feedback on it too. Do you think there is a chance for 16x10 4K monitors? Without yet looking at the real estate gains from 4K monitors in person from the past year, I've been avoiding 16x9 desktop monitors because I think they're garbage. 16x10 would make the resolution 3840x2400 for the consumer, or 4096x2560 for true 4K. I do see their reasons for sticking with 16x9, some of which are likely due to tricky scaling situations previously discussed on the show. So, multi-question here, Josh.
Yeah.
Do you prefer 16:10 over 16:9, and why do you think they have totally gone away from 16:10?
I think it's because of TVs, really. So much content is created for that aspect ratio because everybody's got these widescreen TVs that are 1080p. So the monitor guys have started, you know, creating these, you know, 23, 24 inch panels, and they're all 16x9. The popular panels, like the 2560x1440, 16x9. Now 4K, 16:9. I mean, I think they just want to push the format to there because, I mean, how many 1920x1200 monitors do you see anymore? They're all, you know, professional level, $400 and above for the most part, if you're getting a decent panel. So, yeah, they're just, I think, a lot of pressure from the people who develop the media that you play that, hey, let's not have black bars on 1920x1200 screens. Let's do the same thing for 1080, 1440p, and 4K. Does that sound logical to you?
Yeah, no, I think that's probably what it is. It's just, you got to look at, there's a limit to the number of panels that can be manufactured. And so I'm guessing switching between manufacturing 16:10 and 16:9 is not a inconsequential thing, right? So if they've got to pick one, they're going to go with that. So the reason that this email was exceptionally interesting to me today is like a couple of hours before I had read it, Alan was complaining to me about the fact that the 4K monitors we have here are all 16:9, and he wanted something that was 16:10. And he was actually hoping to find, you know, why weren't there going to be low-cost IPS 16:10, 25:16 panels, right? As opposed to, you know, the low-cost 25:14 panels. And I tried to tell him he was an old stodgy man and just get over it. You know, you gotta move on. You gotta get on with the times. But
and then he took the iFixit thing and he took apart your hopes and aspirations for your future. You know, because you called him an old cranky man.
But looking around, like the two panels I have on my personal desk are 16:10. The two that Ken use are 16:10. The one on the GPU test bed is 16:10, and the one on the CPU test bed is 16:10. Aspect ratios. So I obviously prefer that, but it's just not something that's really being made much anymore. I mean, can you think of a 16:10 ratio monitor other than like the 30-inch, like the Dell 3009 or what are we at now, 3014?
You know, like the Asus Pro Series, again, it's a $400 IPS monitor, but that's 1900 by 12. Wait, yeah. And, you know, some of those, I think a lot of medical imaging, they may actually be the higher resolution. The Dell 30 inches that we've had forever, 2560x1600s. But yeah, it seems like it's kind of a dying breed, which is sad because I do prefer 1920x1200 rather than the 1080p. Those extra vertical pixels are kind of nice when I'm doing photo editing and writing an article side by side with a PDF. And
that was essentially Alan's complaint as well, that vertical space means more when you're dealing with form factors. You know, movies are horizontal, but web pages, documents, those are all vertical items. So just get three 16:9 monitors and turn them in portrait mode, and there you go.
Yeah.
Solution fixed. We got an email from Patrick, not the one who's missing here today, I assume. He says, what do you think about gaming performance of external GPUs for laptops with this adapter? And he provided a link for us that Burke will pull up. Is there a penalty or bottleneck? And by how much, since you will be using the express card slot or MPCIe of the laptop? One may argue to simply buy a gaming laptop with discrete graphics, but the problem is they are either too heavy or have heat problems and throttle down the CPU and GPU. In my case, I don't play games every day, but when I do, I want to play with high settings. So the clunky setup is okay for me. I don't know. I had not seen this particular device before, and it may not be something that actually exists. It's apparently... I don't know. It's available in a web shop of some kind, Josh. I don't know if you pulled up this link to look at it.
You know, I did not.
It is essentially like a baseboard with a PCI Express slot on it and ATX like power connections on it. And then you buy an adapter to connect it through either Express card, MPCIe, or you can actually get a PCIe add-in card, which is kind of weird. Like the idea of using a PCI Express add-in card into a desktop computer to attach a desktop. I don't really know what's going on with that. So the idea
it's a real thing. It certainly looks like it works.
I guess. So
how many times have we seen it?
Yes, exactly.
And has it
right?
never taken off?
It's there's a reason why it hasn't taken off yet. There has to be a reason because the idea is perfect. I've got this ultra thin laptop and it doesn't have a graphics card in it. And I don't want to have to worry about potential issues with having a big GPU with a big cooler in case I do win a game. So I'll just leave all that at home. I go on my work trip. I take my Ultrabook with me or my ultra thin machine. I come home. I plug in this one cable and it's got a GTX, I don't know, 670 in it or something. Right. And it's hooked up to a monitor and I connect it into my laptop through the Thunderbolt port, which is the newest thing. And in this case, it's using Express Card or MPCIe, which I honestly don't even know what that is. And, you know, it's got an external power brick for the graphics card and you go, you can play games. It's a great idea. And every CES, we see this in every Computex, we see this. It was a big deal again when Thunderbolt was kind of rolling out, right? They're like, oh, look, what you'll be able to do with Thunderbolt. But none of it ever panned out. And there has absolutely got to be a reason for it. I think Express Card's bandwidth is going to be limiting it dramatically in this case. I don't have the standards in front of me to look it up, but I would guess that Express Card is probably what, maybe PCIe 1.0 four lanes or something like that of bandwidth.
Yeah, about that.
Express Card's not on laptops anymore, right? Like for the majority.
No, you probably think I've seen laptops. One. I
do. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't see this device actually for sale anywhere. If it were reasonably priced, I might buy one and try to make it work. But I don't see it available. There are some other companies that sell stuff like this. MSI was prototyping one for a while, but it never actually came out for sale. I don't know. Yeah. Who's that?
Make one.
Oh, well, yeah. Which one was that, Burke? I see you showing it there. Is that an MSI actual device? I see an MSI video card going in it. Oh, wait, no. Okay, I see what you're showing. This is from the same company. I don't know. Like, I don't trust any of it, and I would never tell anybody, a viewer, to buy it until I was able to see it working in person and, like, actually buy one and test it, right? Because they have all kinds of issues, right? How big is that power supply? How big of a graphics card can you put in there? And are you going to have bandwidth limitations?
Oh, yeah, by the way, our power supply is 90-watt, this 90-watt brick, so... Good luck on putting a high-end card in that.
You could probably get a 750 Ti in there, right?
Yeah.
The idea is perfect. I just don't trust it. I don't trust it.
I think it's just primarily they've probably talked to manufacturers and notebook guys, and they're like, you know what? We see no interest because nobody ever asks for anything like this. We sell, you know, every notebook we sell, or, you know, every 15 we sell maybe one docking port enabled notebook that somebody will actually do something. I mean, what are the chances when they look at the numbers and think, okay, how many of these people are going to actually utilize this thing? Well, let's take a look at how many docks we actually sold. Wow, that's not many. I would imagine they sell one dock per every 50 notebooks. Wouldn't you say so?
Yeah.
I mean, that's reasonable.
Laptops I've bought, I've never bought a dock.
Yeah. I've bought multiple for my company, and I've bought one dock so far. So, yeah. I don't think the market's there.
Alex inside the chat is saying that he's pretty sure Express Card is buy four on new laptops, but he doesn't know what PCI Express version there is.
Yeah, it's probably 2.0, but anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, I think we're going to wrap that up. We had another question in here, but it's much too storage-based for me to grasp. So we'll save that for next week after I can get some input from our storage guy itself. If you're asking about SAS 3 and SCSI, Josh, you have any experience with those?
We've built a couple of servers with SAS. I mean, it's theoretically three, two SATA ports.
SAS 3 and SAS 2?
What's that?
Differences between SAS 3 and SAS 2?
Same thing, kind of, in between. So SATA 2... and SAS 2, I mean, SAS is essentially, I think, combining two SATA links together. So you get double the bandwidth. And so SAS 3 is using SATA 3G with two links, if I'm correct. And I think I am. So, yeah, it's just a faster and more enterprise-aimed connection.
Gotcha. All right.
Right.
We'll go with that. If you have questions for us, we encourage you to send them in. Twitch at twit.tv, T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv is the place to send those. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Ryan Shrout. And Josh, where can they find you?
Josh D. Walrath on Twitter.
Josh D. Walrath.
Yeah, not to be confused by Heavy D. Walrath. That's somebody totally different.
Okay. All right. That was going to be my next guest, though. So it's good that you mentioned it.
Yeah.
So that's going to do it for this week in computer hardware. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. You can find us at twit.tv/Twitch. You can go there and find subscribe links for the audio version, the video version, and a bunch of other shows on the Twit Network as well that should interest you. We'll see you next time. Thanks, guys.